Hello all, welcome to the God Said Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Drakonis Books. The God Said Us podcast is a content channel of Kai Drakonis Books. And basically, XDB is an anarchist literary press. Well, I say anarchist literary press because that's easier than saying what it actually is, which is an indie press that publishes literature that engages in some type of social justice issue or something like that, to reflect our anarchist values and as a statement against commodification. All our content, including the books that we publish, are free. So if you're interested in getting free books, go to xidrakonis.org, kaidrakonis.org, to see what we got. I hope that you choose to do so. If you would like to donate to the press, you know, we don't sell our books because, you know, capitalism sucks. But if you want to support us, you can do so at our donate page. Today, I am back with frequent collaborator Hans Berger, and we're going to discuss my favorite Cormac McCarthy novel, The Crossing. And in our preliminary discussion, Hans, you know, I suggested several different topics, and you said any of those could be cool, but then you said, I have no idea how I'm going to say anything meaningful about this book because there's no internality with the characters. And anybody familiar with McCarthy will know that his prose, you know, he never goes inside a character's head. Pretty much never. I've read every one of his books except for The Orchard Keeper and Sutri. I shouldn't say that. In No Country for Old Men, there are some portions in first person. So I guess that would kind of be some internality. But typically, it's all very external. So Hans, you said this made the book difficult for you. You want to talk about that? Start off there?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that I would say it made it difficult to read necessarily, but it's a little bit harder to get thematic content out of, in a way, when you remove the element of internality, it really kind of makes you think about how you work as a reader generally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the, you know, most of the time when you have access to a character's inner life, that plays some role in determining how you're thinking about what their motivations are and why they make their decisions. But it also provides a certain amount of thematic focus. You're aware of how the characters are thinking about the meaning of the events that they're experiencing, and that kind of helps you think about how you approach what they're experiencing. And so to have that removed, it's an interesting choice, I think, partly because it's really the access to internality is one of the things that I think of personally as being one of the things that makes fiction distinctly powerful as a medium. Mm. You know, when you talk about why are there things that you can do with fiction that you're not able to do with film or television? One of the advantages that it has as a medium is that kind of internality. So in a way, you kind of, you know, when you take that out of your arsenal as a writer, and I don't mean this at all, obviously, I don't mean this to be critical of McCarthy because he does very well with it. It's just, it's a choice that I'm sure challenges him as a writer and also challenges the reader because it limits to a certain extent the tools that he has to kind of convey idea and theme.
So let me, okay, so my reaction, not You know, I don't mean this as a statement of disagreement.
Sure.
It's more like I'm trying to think of where we go. Like, he makes the choice not to do internality, and that's limiting. And I agree that I think that it is limiting. Certainly, you know, we could know more about Billy's hopes and fears and whatnot if McCarthy chose to give us those hopes and fears. Mm-hmm. But on the issue of meaning and theme, there seems to be what we have in place of internality would be narrator commentary.
Sure.
So let me just read an example. And this is actually the last sentence of the book, maybe probably my favorite in the entire book. But yeah. I think it's pretty representative of this narrator commentary. So he sat there for a long time, and after a while the east did gray, and after a while the right and God-made sun did rise once again for all and without distinction. So my question is, if internality, the lack of internality, kind of cuts off one route to theme, it seems like we're replacing that route with some of these direct commentaries from the narrator. So we have this value statement, this, you know, this sun that rises over everything without distinction, mm-hmm. is at the same time brutal and merciless, but it's also right and made by God.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? What I'm getting at.
What you're getting at as a larger craft point, or what you're getting at in terms of theme relative to that specific passage?
What I'm getting at as a craft point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and I think you're right that the narration does play a very effective role in that regard. Yeah.
So what if, well, basically, what did you think of that then? If you found the lack of internality, you know, limiting, or it made it hard for you to read or something like that, how were these narrators, these narrators' pronouncements, how did that, was that a good replacement for you, or did you find it not so successful?
Oh, I mean, I thought it was fine. It's
I thought it was
good.
All right.
It's good. Yeah. Well, obviously McCarthy's a great prose stylist. I don't mean to say that I found it inscrutable, because you don't have access to the characters' inner lives. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing too is that there's a segment where, well, particularly towards the middle of the novel, there's also a segment where the main character Billy encounters a series of characters who relate different experiences, really different stories that they've had, and their
right.
thoughts about the meanings of those stories in a way that almost becomes, the way that it's handled within the novel almost becomes very similar to a form of first person narration,
right. kind of
briefly being interpolated into a third person book.
Right.
So it's certainly not to say that there's no way at all to get any access to any kind of theme or meaning. I guess maybe maybe what's happening is that there's just kind of something, there's some way that as much as I enjoyed this book, there's some way that I never quite figured out my way into it, or some way that I never quite connected with it. And I'm trying to find a way to explain that. And I think that I've to a little bit scapegoated the lack of internality as kind
sure.
of an easy way to explain as an easy way to kind of explain just the basic fact of not quite feeling like I get it. And, okay. You know, and part of that, I think, might be that there's a way that things have a part of that might be how episodic it is for a while. Mm-hmm. Particularly again toward the middle section of the novel where you have the episode with the wolf at the beginning of, that's roughly the first third of the book.
Right.
And that's pretty easy to follow. And that is, it's pretty easy to follow. And it is thematically, I think, pretty transparent. You know, if you were to take just that section, and approach it on its own terms, I could speak pretty well about my own understanding of what that means and why all that happens. And then after he buries the wolf, there's the section where he has the experiences with the eyeless man and the I can't even remember off the top of my head who all he encounters. And it might be helpful to just kind of go through
there's the eyeless man. Then there is the steward of the ruined town that was ruined in the earthquake. That's actually the first one.
Okay.
Then there's the eyeless man. What other long story is there? There's the major domo of the opera. She doesn't tell a super long story.
Mm-hmm. There's a priest, isn't there, too?
The steward of the town tells a story. Yeah, yeah, he's the priest.
Okay, And because there's not really... Sorry, go ahead.
But it's not in the middle of the book. It's at the end of the book. There's the story about the airplanes from the traveling gitanos.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah, there's that series of in the middle of the book where he really is just kind of wandering and encountering these different people with their stories and their reflections on the stories. And because you lose a certain amount of narrative momentum in that section, and
right. yeah.
And that was kind of where I started to feel a little bit lost, perhaps.
Right, the first third with the wolf has excellent narrative drive. It just keeps moving forward. You know what's happening. You know why things are happening. And then after the wolf is buried, it's very wandering. You're not sure exactly what's happening next or why.
Which I suppose is appropriate because that's how Billy is feeling as well during that time. I mean, that's...
Right.
Structurally it's kind of duplicating his, we were talking earlier about the lack of access to inner life. And I suppose what's happening there is that the way the novel is organized is kind of replicating the sense of drift and confusion that he's probably having during that same time.
Absolutely.
And then he meets back up with Boyd, and there's the confrontation where the man is knocked off his horse and paralyzed, and right. Boyd is shot. And again, I mean, that's also that section almost has kind of an absurd feel to it, you know, because everything is the action is so understated in the way that it's narrated and the way that it happens. And
right.
Again, has a kind of inscrutability to it, partly because you don't have access to the character's thoughts in the moment about what's happening. And because everything kind of seems like it happens half by accident.
Right.
And again, I mean, the sense of confusion that you have reading that, probably mirrors pretty well how it feels to the characters to be experiencing it.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
And the so there's the confrontation where Boyd is shot. And then there's the period where Billy is trying to get into the military, and he's unable to do that because he has a bad heart. pardon me. And that seemed pretty thematically resonant, I guess. It's interesting, the idea of... yeah, it's such an insightful comment, right? The idea that he can't get into the military because he has a bad heart, that's so... I didn't really think about it until I put it into those terms, but that's so... It's one of those things that as a metaphor, it's kind of inching up to the point of being... As a metaphor, it's inching up to the point of being too much, but because it's all written so in such a kind of low-key... minimally narrated fashion, you don't really... He's able to get away with it, I think, partly because of the way the prose is kind of stripped and mild and doesn't push itself into things too much.
That's interesting. I had never thought of that metaphor. He can't get in because he has a bad heart. And that raises a question. I mean, what would it mean for, if we're speaking metaphorically, you know, what would it mean for Billy to have a bad heart? What about him suggests that he has a bad heart?
Well, I wonder, and I mean, having said what I said a minute ago, I'm not sure that he has... To just say that he has a bad heart, I don't think is literally true. I mean, if anything, he seems less cruel, less malicious than most of the people around him.
Right.
It does seem like it comes back to... One of the things about not having access to the characters' inner lives is... We were talking earlier about the section with the wolf, and...
Yeah.
Even though that is, I mean, taken just on its own, that's generally a pretty understandable section. It's notable that the kind of the core decision that sets off the whole chain of what comes for the rest of the novel is the decision to trap the wolf, tame the wolf, try to manage it, and take it back into the mountains of Mexico to release it, rather than allow it to be killed or kill it. And that in the moment of reading it, seems like a good-hearted thing to do. Seems like a maybe not a wise choice, but it's, you know, it's something that,
right,
as a reader, it's very easy to say, oh, that's good. That's a good thing to do. Right. That's kind of him. It's folly, really, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's folly, and all it does is prolong the suffering of the wolf and, you know, take him away from his family in a way that has disastrous consequences. And right. And that's kind of, I mean, that folly is sort of the core. That folly is maybe the core of the tragedy of the book, I think.
Right, absolutely.
But what is the nature of that folly? How do you describe that choice? At the time that I was reading it, I was thinking that maybe it had something to do with nature, right? With the attempt, what he's attempting to do is exert control over nature in a way that is fundamentally corrupting. You know, to tame the wolf, to treat the wolf as something other than an unknowable wild thing, potentially an adversary, is to corrupt it. You know, the only two things,
right,
the only things that he has, two things that he can do with the wolf. He can destroy it, or he can corrupt it. He has no other choice in his relationship to the wolf. And right. And he ends up having to destroy it. And if he were to recognize at the beginning of the, if he were to recognize quickly that his only choice is to destroy it, then he would have been better off. And that seems very pessimistic, for lack of a better word.
Right. And, you know, I find that's something that I ponder a lot with this book. This is my second time reading it. And, you know, I wonder ultimately, is this a pessimistic novel? And I made a note, I made a note in the audiobook, so it doesn't tell me exactly what page it is. But there's a section where the narrator compares the perfect cohesion of the world to darkness.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that in its natural state, there's cruelty, there's pain, there's despair,
yeah.
And it seems, you know, if we take Billy's actions as representative of what's going to, you know, as representative of a worldview that the narrator is trying to put forward, then we have this perfectly cohesive, brutal, cruel world, human beings attempting to change that cruelty or control that cruelty or undo that cruelty, and the despair and brutality and cruelty always reasserting itself.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Yeah, it does. And it's hard for me to believe it's hard for me to accept that as a final endpoint.
Right. Yeah. I really hope that that's not, but I'm not exactly sure.
I'm not sure how to argue anything else.
Right. Absolutely. I do know that one thing that I mentioned to you before is that I feel like the novel is constantly vacillating between these two positions. So on the one hand, you have this perfect brutality and human beings trying to be kind always fails. And yet you have, despite the fact that there are many situations in the novel in which cruelty seems to pop up, really there are lots of situations in which kindness pops up as well. You know,
yeah.
many people give comfort and succor to Billy frequently.
Yeah.
You know, many people give him a place to sleep. People give him a place to eat.
There's the experience with the gypsies toward the end of the novel where they help his horse.
Right.
They help him. That's
yeah. They tell him that whacked out story that's not true, but they do help his horse.
Yeah, that's something, I guess.
So,
well,
you know, but that's what I'm talking about, the vacillation. So, like, the gypsies help his horse, then they tell him this story that is supposed to shed some light on maybe his situation, and then a guy comes along and is like, yeah, that's all lies.
Yeah.
And, like, none of that is true. Which I find hilarious, actually.
Yeah.
Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I wonder if that vacillation, if that kind of unsettledness and that back and that push and pull of cruelty and kindness, if rather than being, I mean, maybe the way to read that is not as a refusal to settle on a particular, not as a failure to settle on a particular outcome or standpoint, but if the point is in fact that switch, that back and forth, or that it's partly about, if maybe it is partly about the kind of push and pull between kindness and cruelty.
Right.
And I mean, I suppose that at the beginning of the novel, at the beginning or in the first third of the novel, there's an attempt to exert kindness on the world, to push back against cruelty, and that attempt fails. But I wonder, the fact that that particular, if is there some reason that the fact that that particular attempt to be kind fails, but maybe other attempts at kindness in the novel don't, right? Or if there are other places right. where, is there some way we can make a distinction between places in the novel where kindness succeeds or is valuable, as opposed to that kind of initial folly where kindness becomes this accidentally destructive force?
Okay, let's think about that. So beyond the you know, the kind of mundane kindness of feeding someone or giving someone a place to sleep, there's the kindness of the farmers who, or truck drivers, I'm assuming they're farmers, mm-hmm. who pick up Boyd when they're running away from the people who are trying to kill them.
Yeah.
And then later the doctor comes when Billy can't pay and heals Boyd.
Yeah.
So there's that kindness that seems to be successful. But of course, Boyd ultimately dies. So maybe not. But it had the short-term goal of healing Boyd succeeds. So we'll right. say that's a we'll give kindness one score on that. Mm-hmm. So let's take that example. Why do we think that succeeds? When say at the end of the novel, when the scrabby, disgusting dog is looking for a place to sleep, and Billy shoos it away.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately Billy comes, and this is more vacillation. Ultimately Billy wakes up, and it's like, come back. Like he has this seeming moment of empathy. Mm-hmm. But so.
Right. And I mean, presumably to take the stray dog in would have been the right thing to do.
Presumably.
I mean,
but it could have been folly.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the stray right? dog. Yeah. Maybe like the next day he would catch the stray dog digging up Boyd's remains, and then there'd be, well, you can't, I don't know, you can't game that kind of thing out, I guess, but
right.
That's interesting. I mean, maybe it's funny how the image, his relationship to the wolf at the beginning of the novel mirrors his relationship to the stray dog at the end. And at right. the beginning of the novel, he has it in himself to be kind to the wolf, and it fails. And at the end of the novel, he rejects the stray dog. And then at the end of the novel, he rejects the stray dog and then weeps for that rejection. And I right. wonder, is the idea of that, I wonder, that he's learned, you know, he's learned not to be unduly kind. He's learned the folly of trying to help.
Right.
But then he can't accept the understanding that that is folly. Is that the idea? Or is there some sense in which being kind to the wolf was an error, but being kind to the stray dog would be the right thing to do? And he's, you know, in weeping for his failure to be kind to the stray dog, is he finally coming to some sense of understanding of how to weigh those questions. I wonder if it has something to do with, the fact that the wolf is, you know, the wolf is a thing of nature, and the dog is not. If it's something to do with the difference between.
Yeah, the dog is I swear the narrator says the dog is unnatural.
Really? I almost want to.
Let me look. I got my book. Okay.
Yeah, I got mine here too.
He got that blank. Billy set the sardines. You could see. Okay. He got his blankets and spread them in the hay, and he was sitting eating sardines out of a tin and watching the rain when a yellow dog rounded the side of the building and entered through the open door and stopped. It looked first at the horse. Then it swung its head and looked at him. It was an old dog gone gray about the muzzle, and it was horribly crippled in its hindquarters, and its head was askew some way on its body, and it moved grotesquely. An arthritic and ill-joined thing that crabbed sideways and sniffed at the floor to pick up the man's scent, and then raised its head and nudged the air with its nose and tried to sort him from the shadows with its milky, half-blind eyes. Let's see.
Well, I don't know if he uses the word unnatural specifically, yeah, I think he uses grotesque a couple of times. I mean, he really emphasizes that this is a nasty dog.
Yeah, grotesque, ill-joined, repository of 10,000 indignities and the harbinger of God knew what.
Yeah.
So maybe not unnatural. He compares it to an awful composite of grief that had broke through the preterite world. So maybe unnatural is not the right word, but preterite would suggest that it's more like the wolf, right? Coming from somewhere unknowable.
My understanding of preterite, and maybe there are different contexts it can be used in. The preterite are the opposite of the in like Calvinist theology. There's the chosen and then the unchosen, right? The people who are chosen to be saved and the people who are chosen to be not saved. And I believe that's what preterite refers to.
Let me see.
I was thinking about this.
I mean, I just looked it up, and it just says expressing a past action or state. The preterite world is, the past world, the world out of the past, is what I would think.
Because I've been rereading Gravity's Rainbow, and Gravity's Rainbow is very fixated on the idea of the preterite, those who are unsaved. And my understanding of it from that is that the preterite is the ones who are unsaved because they're chosen by God to be unsaved, and that part of what Gravity's, I mean, the main character Tyrone Slothrop, he has theological ancestors, or he has ancestors who are theologians who are opposed to the basic idea of preterite, of preterition existing.
Okay. I mean, I feel like either way, either term makes sense. Like the preterite in your connotation would suggest that the dog has been singled out for this deformity. And that would make total sense with the last line, you know, the right and God made sun rising on everybody without any distinction. Yeah, go on.
So Wikipedia says, and I think this lines it more up with your understanding of the term than mine. Preterism is a Christian eschatological view that interprets some or all prophecies of the Bible as events which have already happened. So, for instance, the idea that the Book of Revelation, where most Christians think of the Book of Revelation as a prophecy of some future apocalypse, preterism would construe the Book of Revelation as being a description of events that happened in the first, a metaphorical description of events that happened in the first century BC.
Oh, okay. Okay. Huh.
So I don't know. I think that there must be layers of meaning to the use of that term I don't know if I can educate myself about this enough in real time to offer a particularly good commentary.
Well, I think we can at least draw away from this the idea that the multiple layers of preterite seem to be working each one of them.
Sure.
They seem to be working.
In that sentence, yeah.
So, I don't know. And I actually, when I think about this book as a whole and McCarthy as a writer, thematically, I feel like he's a writer I should hate.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he does seem to resist any solid position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that make sense? Like, I feel like we're finding out that there are multiple ways that we could look at this book, and these multiple ways all seem to be relatively reasonable.
Sure.
Right? They all seem reasonable. So I don't know. I mean, shouldn't I dislike it that he's not willing to settle on anything? Not that I should, but.
Not that you should, but that it occurs to you that you could.
Right. It occurs to me that I could.
Yeah, maybe so. And maybe I am. I mean, I keep puzzling over the question of why is it good to be kind to the stray dog, but bad to be kind to the wolf? Why is that?
Right.
And I almost feel like that, maybe I'm simplifying too much to say it, but that almost feels to me like maybe the core, if there is a core moral question of this novel, maybe you can kind of boil it down there, right? Why is kindness, why is kindness destructive in some context, in one context, and potentially at least healing in another?
Right.
And maybe there's not an answer. Maybe the fact that you can't boil it down to a simple guideline, or the fact that you can't predict outcomes like that. Maybe I should accept that ambiguity rather than try to come up with some kind of system to parse it out.
And you know, I find that interesting because it's usually people who want to criticize the project of science, which is trying to reach for certainties.
Mm-hmm.
It's typically people who want to criticize that view who insist on the unknowability of things,
mm-hmm.
you know, the unpredictability of things.
And
I find that interesting, knowing that McCarthy was a kind of science advisor for he was a science writer for this science think tank in New Mexico for a long time. So I find it hard to attribute that the position to him that he would really be criticizing science as a project,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. Maybe we should shift gears. I feel like one thing that we haven't talked about, and that I think is actually extremely important, it's the question of borders.
Yeah.
So, and maybe this can shed some light on some of our other discussion. So the novel plays with this idea of borders. So early on, it seems to suggest that the wolf has some concept of borders, you know, not willing to cross mm-hmm. roads in the open and things like that, But then when Billy is talking to the sheriff, who has kind of commandeered the wolf, the sheriff says, you know, it doesn't really matter whether you didn't know about our laws. It doesn't really matter because those laws stand anyway.
Right.
You know, the fact that you've crossed this border, even if you're not aware of it, it still stands.
Right.
And then I think that there are other examples of this later in the novel too, when he goes back to the U.S., he comes on Christmas Eve, and then the next day everything's closed, and he's like, well, why is everything closed? And somebody's like, it's Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
So he's clearly, that to me seems like he's kind of the tether that held him to an understanding of borders or an understanding of culture has been loosed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then later, somebody else indicates that, I think it's during the discussion with the gypsies, the gypsies indicate that borders are artificial. They're made by human beings. So I wonder, where do you think the novel stands on this idea of borders? Do we think that borders are essential, not essential, are artificial, non-artificial, a combination? I don't know.
I suppose the fact that, and I don't know if this is necessarily the position that the novel is taking, but it does seem to me that the fact that something is artificial doesn't mean that it's not still consequential, right?
Right, absolutely.
The border is, obviously the border is an artifice, obviously the border is an invention, but it's become a very consequential invention. And
right.
Billy not realizing that it's Christmas Day, that's not necessarily, that doesn't diminish the importance of the fact that it is Christmas Day, you know?
Right.
And I don't know if, maybe it's too much to try to spin that up into a thematic statement. I don't know.
Hmm.
It is interesting to me, actually. Well, it's interesting that part of what he, you know, when Billy is trying to save the wolf, his idea of how to save the wolf is to take it back over the border. Even though the wolf does not, it's said that the wolf doesn't recognize borders. The narrator, in as you pointed out, the narrator kind of says that the wolf is ignorant of borders. And I wonder if, going back to, I keep coming back to the question of why is it folly to try to save the wolf? Maybe partly because his vision of how to try to save the wolf is to restore it to its position relative to a border, even though, you know, that border is to the wolf an invention.
Right. And it seems to be that, like, people in Mexico are just as hostile to the wolf as people in America.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so... Mm-hmm.
Well,
so definitely, like, the idea of the border, that would seem to indicate where part of the folly, definitely, because the wolf is presumably, you know, even if it's not aware of borders, it's chosen its own course.
Right. Right.
It's directed itself. So why, you know, part of the folly is interfering with this other creature that's directed its own course.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Interesting. Super interesting.
Yeah.
And I think also the fact that a significant portion of the dialogue of this novel is just, it's in Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's in Spanish. And he doesn't make it totally opaque. You know, after a piece of dialogue, he will sometimes kind of add a summary paragraph.
Sure.
Or you know, then he'll lapse out of the dialogue and he'll lapse back into third person, and you're able to pick up on what the gist of it is.
Yeah.
And I'm an attentive reader, so I found myself again stopping to kind of look up words to figure out what's going on. But I feel like that is reflective of this question about borders as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least for the reader. I mean, Billy seems to be able to speak Spanish fluently.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and it's interesting too, that it's really never that difficult for him to cross the border that I can recall.
Right.
In his own travel, the border really never seems to exist as an obstacle.
Right. He's like, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting that the title of the novel is The Crossing, which presumably you could take as referring to border crossing, when in fact the literal event of crossing the border tends to be very minor in the
right.
In the action of the novel.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if I can boil all that down into anything particularly meaningful, but
that's okay. I mean, regardless, I feel like it's personally I love it, and mm-hmm. and I think that I ultimately, whether even though I'm not able to necessarily draw out what, you know, what the author is trying to get at. And I know some people think that's just a dumb question. I personally like it, but that's beside the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But ultimately, I like the novel because it's a combination of, we had this discussion before, it's a combination of an engaging story with an empathetic main character that's thematically very rich,
right.
even if we're not quite able to understand everything, I think both of these things are in the novel anyway.
Oh, certainly, certainly. I mean, and the fact that you can't distill it into an argument. Well, for me personally, many of my favorite novels can't be easily distilled into an argument. And I mean, I think I said in our conversation about Don DeLillo, relative to my own aesthetic, I tend to be a little wary of novels that can be distilled to an easy argument.
Right.
And I suppose it's kind of interesting to think about just in the books that we've read, you know, there's the books we've read for this podcast, there's the easy argument books and the not an easy argument books, you know.
Right.
Jude the Obscure is an argument.
Right. Absolutely.
And I suppose something like A Naked Singularity, to the extent that it's a critique of the justice system, it is an argument. And there are things that are obscure about that book, but none of them really have anything to... The things that are obscure aren't thematic. There are other things that are obscure.
Right, right.
So it's interesting, and that might be part of why it was difficult for me to approach The Crossing, is because the last couple things that we had read, you could engage with on an argument level in a way that you really can't with this book. So the frame the frame I'd been using the last couple times didn't kind of broke down a little bit here. So,
and then that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true.
All right.
Well, what are we reading next, Hans?
I've been going back and forth. I think I've settled on, have you read or encountered or heard of Zeroville by Steve Erickson?
I have not. Zeroville.
I was a little wary of this one because for the podcast, because I don't know that it's something that, it's definitely not an argument book. It's not something that And your reading of it may be different. For me, I'm not sure that you can necessarily pull a social justice question out of it, but it is something that I am very interested in talking to an intelligent reader about.
Okay. It's about the Charles Manson mass murder?
No, it's not. The Manson murders are peripherally involved, and I think...
Oh, okay.
Because of that peripheral involvement, I think because that's an easy marketing hook, some of what you run into makes it seem like it's about the Manson murders. Maybe it is secretly, and I didn't pick up on that. I don't know. Maybe that's... Maybe in your reading you'll find that it's more central than I thought. But yeah, that's my pick.
A young excommunicated seminarian arrives with images of Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift tattooed on his head. All right, yeah, this looks like one of those books that I have no idea how it's going to turn out, but I'm sure it'll be fun.
If you want to, actually, Chris has read it. I don't know if we want to try to get Chris for a... You know.
Yeah, that'd be super fun. We okay. probably should, actually.
Okay, yeah.
I will send him a message on the Facebook and see if he wants to join us to talk about this here in a little while when I get a chance to listen to it.
Okay. It's relatively short. It'll go quickly.
Yeah. It's 9 hours. That's not a super long audiobook.
And I've read it a couple times, so I'll be ready whenever you're. I mean, I'm still going to refresh myself on it, but I can.
All right.
I'll be ready whenever you're ready.
Okay, I'm currently reading Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed for my next discussion with Jed.
Oh, cool.
I'm also currently reading Janet Frame's The Carpathians.
Oh, I just read that.
Next... Did you?
Yeah. Because I had read, I still had a copy of, oh Christ, what is it? Were you in the comedy class with Rich Carr?
No.
Oh, well, so Rich Carr, one of Rich Carr's lit classes, we read Living in the Maniototo by Janet Frame.
Right.
And I... happened to dig that up about a year ago and reread it and enjoyed it really immensely. And I asked Rich for a recommendation for a different Janet Frame, and he recommended The Carpathians. So I finished that maybe 2-3 months ago. So
I did take Lit of Oceania with Rich, in which we read a bunch of stuff from Australia, New Zealand, and Polynesia.
Okay.
So The Carpathians could have fit in there, but he didn't have us read it. That'd actually be fun. Maybe we should have a three-way convo about the Carpathians.
Sure.
And then a three-way convo about Zeroville.
Yeah. I mean, I would certainly be... The Carpathians is another one that I wasn't sure what to make of it, but I mean, I certainly would be happy to reread it for the conversation. If there's three people, I can feel a little less insecure about being overwhelmed and confused.
No reason to feel insecure. Yeah, I'm about halfway through the Carpathians, and I'm like, I have no idea what this is about. Like,
yeah,
she's here in New Zealand, and maybe her memories are becoming real. You know, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, cool. That sounds awesome. So everybody who is listening, you just got kind of a preview of what's coming up next. I don't know whether I'm going to discuss The Dispossessed with Jed Cole next, or whether what's next is The Carpathians with Hans and Chris, but stay tuned for those. They will appear in your podcast subscriptions here in a little bit. Hans, as always, man, it's great to chat with you. And I'm glad that you gave Mr. McCarthy a chance.
All right. Well, no, thanks so much for having me as well.
Yeah.
Have a good
one. It was my pleasure. Peace out, man.